Okay, today I'm in Camden Town in London with Alan Alger, who is the head of PR for Betway, if I'm correct, Alan. No, first straight in, something a lot of people probably don't know. You scored the last goal at Highbury.
Yeah, it's a bit of a, I guess some people might call it a bit of a tenuous claim, but it was the last official match at Highbury with what you would call proper officials and an actual proper 11-a-side game. And it was a charity game, Football Aid, just before the stadium was knocked down. In fact, I think the builders came in the following day and it was sold on Football Aid for their tremendous charity work they do with Diabetes UK and a few other charities. And I managed to bid to play up front for the home team, as in wearing the home shirts, in the second half of the game. But I think someone didn't turn up, so I managed to get about 10 minutes in the first half as well. And I played up front, and if people know me, I'm actually a defender. So I was appalling, absolutely appalling. I think I took a corner that went out for a goal kick before it even came into play. I don't think I had one shot on target during the whole game, but as people might have seen on the video, we get given the dodgiest penalty you've ever seen in probably the fifth minute of what could have only been 2 minutes of injury time at 3-2 down. And because I'd paid to play up front, it did actually include taking any penalties that occur in the game. So I went and picked up the ball, and as I walked back and the other team were complaining, I did then sort of realise that I was just about to take a penalty that could either be the last goal scored at Highbury or a miss that would haunt me forever. And luckily the keeper was, no offence to him if he's watching, but slightly overweight, so I managed to put it in what I've always said was the top corner postage stamp, but if you look at the replay, it's probably just quite high and just out of his reach. So amazing thing, and something that lived with me forever, and I will bore people to tears with it. And you've opened up with it, so people will be switching off in their droves.
Probably an obvious question, Alan, but you're a big Arsenal fan then.
Absolutely. From the very early 80s when, had two uncles, and obviously my dad was a Chelsea fan, one of my uncles was a Tottenham fan, and the other uncle was an Arsenal fan. And I used to go to Chelsea, I used to go to Arsenal quite a lot, I used to go to Tottenham quite a lot, believe it or not, and the local team at the time was Charlton, so I would just go to any football match I could with any of the adults that would take me along. And in fact, if anything, at the time, Arsenal were probably in the middle of those sort of four teams in terms of success. Tottenham were winning the FA Cup quite regularly. I think they won it in 81 and 82, and Chelsea were doing reasonably well. Arsenal were having a bit of a low period, but I enjoyed going to Arsenal much, much more. And when it was time to make that decision, I made the decision with Arsenal, and I'd say it probably was the right one overall. And obviously we've had a lot of success. It's great supporting them, and obviously I moan about them quite a lot, especially in the last 10 years, but overall I don't think you can get a better club to support.
So career-wise, you started as a junior trainer for City Index. Where did the interest in betting come from?
I think like a lot of people say in these interviews, it definitely came from my dad. He was a horse racing punter. I remember sitting down watching races with him. I remember being lucky enough to go to a few tracks with him whenever he went with his friends. I think one holiday in Yarmouth was probably the first time I ever went racing. I'm not sure whether it was Lingfield on a sort of bank holiday once or Yarmouth on a family holiday, but definitely Lingfield and Yarmouth were the first two courses I ever went to when I was very, very young. And I just loved everything about it. I was, you know, massively interested in the numbers, the atmosphere, everything to do with it. And obviously the part of winning the money and the money involved, just being given a quid to choose a horse by my dad was, you know, something that I just loved doing. And that interest just grew from there. But I also remember sitting there with my dad a lot of the time on a Saturday, and he'd be like, yeah, I've had that horse that's won, thinking, you're staking these wrong. You should be winning lots of money. How comes you're not? And he's like, yeah, but I've done it in such a way. And being fascinated by the way that he would place his multiples and thinking maybe there was a better way to do it. And I still tell him that now.
So you started with City Index and Spreadbet firm, and then you went to SpreadX, and then you suddenly shifted into PR with Sportingbet. How did that happen?
Well, going back to the City Index answer, being a junior there, obviously they had a big sports spread betting side as well as their financial side, owned by ICAP, big financial institution in the city. I wasn't drifting between roles, but I'd always wanted to be a journalist when I was younger, and that didn't really work out in terms of personal situation and education. I needed to get a job. I ended up in a couple of office jobs that I didn't really enjoy that much. I wouldn't say I absolutely hated them, but I definitely thought there was much more to life. And one particular job that I got stuck in was an insurance telesales job that I absolutely hated. And it was one of those places where you have to put your hand up to go to the toilet. And I don't care whether you're 22, 42, 52, if you're doing that in a job, it's really demeaning, and there's got to be more to life. And I'd obviously kept up an interest in football, sport, betting, was a regular race goer and a regular reader of the Racing Post. And one Saturday, I remember it vividly, I was on a shift at this insurance company and actually really contemplating what I would do next. And it was, bolt from the blue. There was an advert in the paper for junior traders, either with Blue Square, who were part of ICAP at the time, and obviously I ended up working there, so we'll come to that in a bit, and with City Index. And I remember just looking at the advert, applying, and just wanting that more than anything I've wanted in my life. And especially when I then went to the interview, I was lucky enough to get an interview. And the first interview I had was quite a tough interview with a guy called Stephen Tucker, who is a sort of very well-respected punter in the game. I don't think he's got much of a social profile, but he's still involved heavily. And I remember him drilling me on percentages and the way that bookmaking works. And luckily, I think I just about did enough within that interview to still be considered. And then a few changes happened within the company, and that section of the company was actually passed on to someone called Mark Harbour, who Harry Finley will mention quite often in his interviews and books. Harry was a big friend of Mark Harbour. Unfortunately, Mark passed away a few years ago now. He was a big Arsenal fan. And I remember his interview was totally different to Stephen Tucker's interview. His technique was really just to get me to talk about myself. Now, whether or not I'd already had a big box ticked from the first interview, I'll never know to this day. But I remember him almost sort of saying, "Who do you support, Arsenal? Did you go to the game at the weekend? Okay, you'll do for me." And there wasn't very much to it. And there'll be some people now smiling going, "Yeah, we know you flicked a career in the game." But I just remember thinking, this is all I've ever wanted. And when he said, "When can you start?" I didn't even think about the notice period I had with the insurance companies. It's quite funny, actually. I kept a load of old letters and correspondence, and I remember I've got a letter from them saying, "You won't be getting a reference from us. We've paid you up to the last date. How dare you leave us in this manner?" And I was just thinking, no, I just want to start this job no matter what. I don't care what I lose. I've already got this job. I don't need a reference from you. And the day I started was the day after Manchester United won the treble. The very next day, I went into the offices and started at City Index, and got put next to Ben. Sit next to Ben from Star Sports fame, and he was actually younger than me. I was the first junior intake after Ben's intake. And the really interesting thing that then happened at City Index is that they then took on four or five more juniors and lost a couple of senior staff. Now, I didn't know it at the time, but the reason they lost a couple of senior staff is that City Index were actually trying to get rid of their sports side. And I think a few of the senior traders knew about that and knew that it probably was only going to be around for about another year and a half, 2 years, and they made their move. But them making their move meant that anyone that was on the junior intake got given a hell of a lot of responsibility. I'd definitely say far too early, definitely in my case. I think Ben was very well up on his numbers and his greyhound trading, but I had expressed an interest in the racing side and got given a hell of a lot of racing to do very early on. And if you think back then, it was the days just before the exchanges, and you were offering, obviously in spreads, you were offering a back lay price if you were putting up an index. You could sell or buy. and those prices had to be spot on. And to give a junior that responsibility very early on, when they're only just grasping the concept of pricing up to 100% fixed odds and then converting that into a spread price, to go into doing that maybe 3 months, I would say maybe 3 months into the job, I was there trading maybe the fourth biggest meeting of the day. And by the time it came round again to the following June, the deterioration in the senior staff there, again because of the rumours that City Index was just operating as a loss leader for the financial side and those guys trying to continue their careers, it meant by the time I came in the next June, I actually traded Royal Ascot. All of the indices for Royal Ascot, all of the match bets for Royal Ascot, how we made money that week, I do not know. But that was a baptism of fire to go in and do all that. And essentially you find out then it was because the senior staff, I think it'd be unfair to say that they downed tools, but I think they were well aware that the situation in the company meant that they probably weren't as committed as they should have been. But in some ways that was a really, really good grounding for all the juniors. It really was, because you were thrown in at the deep end, and a few of the football guys have gone on to work at, you know, places like Star Lizard, and they've carved out great careers, and obviously you don't go there if you're not shrewd. So I guess that it was an unusual way for people to start their careers, but in a lot of ways I think the vast majority of us benefited from that. And when City Index was sold by ICAP, it was sold to Sporting Index, and a few of the guys had interviews lined up. I think the hierarchy at City Index actually, maybe they felt sorry for the junior traders that had given a lot of work over that year and a half, 2 years. They arranged interviews with Sporting Index for all the juniors. And they also reached out to Spreadex as well and asked them if they would take any of the juniors. They were a new spread betting firm at the time. And I think very quickly had an interview with Spreadex. I think it was pretty much as soon as I'd had the redundancy handed to me, I'd had an interview arranged with Spreadex. We were up in Dunstable at the time. And I remember going up there and getting the job within the first interview, and actually coming out and going to the estate agents there and getting a flat in Dunstable, which if anybody's been to Dunstable, no offence, is probably not something you should do within half an hour of getting the job there. You should probably research it a little bit more, because no detriment to Spreadex, who treated me incredibly well, Dunstable wasn't the place to go and plot yourself as a 20-something. And I would say that year and a half, again, no detriment to Spreadex, probably the worst year and a half of my life, but obviously there were some good times as well.
So, Alan, you've been chucking at the deep end. You found you've got an aptitude, and you're taking on clever people in spread betting. You found you've got an aptitude for pricing markets up, etc. Is there a temptation to think, hang on a minute, jump ship and start punting instead of working for bookies?
I think there could always be that temptation, and I guess you're seeing far more now, I guess, with the rise of social media. You're seeing what people are doing with their personal life, especially from in the game, good and bad. And you'll notice a lot of those people are now professionals, and they're making a game of it. I think I'm a confident person, but I don't think I was confident enough to say that I would be able to sustain punting on my own and make a living of it. And the people that do, I've got tremendous respect for. I know a few people that do it. One thing I would say, though, is that some of the people that are on the fringes of professional punting or have been ex-traders, certainly from the intake maybe around the mid-2000s, I think a lot of them, with their anonymous accounts on Twitter and the criticism that they give to a lot of people that have carved out careers in the industry, I always find that very interesting, because a lot of time that criticism is coming from people that have not only possibly failed within the industry, but also they're criticising people that have got families, they don't know the personal situations of those people, and also these people are actually not only being paid money to work within the industry, and you know it is quite a rewarding career, they're also being paid to also be involved and they can punt on the side. So I've never really seen why you would try and make that distinction. The people that do and make a success of it, I've got tremendous respect for. The people in the middle who try and have it both ways, I've never quite understood, because I think you can earn a very good career from this game and also keep your eye in hunting wise as well. And I don't think you'd ever need to make that distinction, especially if you've got a family. And I wouldn't be one to risk having to bet for a wage. I don't think I could take that risk. And I quite wholeheartedly admit I'm probably not good enough either to do that. I make a reasonable amount on the things that I study and probably give it away on the things that I don't.
Going back to what you said in the last part, you jumped in with both feet into Dunstable, found you weren't really enjoying yourself much, so what happened next?
What happened next was I fell out with my line manager at the time, who I subsequently made it up with and then worked for again, and we had absolutely no issue. But I would hold my hand up and probably say it was my fault. I think I'd come from City Index, and because I'd been given so much responsibility at City Index, where they didn't have particularly much of a structure, because as I say, the senior staff were looking for their exit. Because we've been given too much responsibility too soon, I probably went into a place like Spreadex I have to admit, I probably went in there really big-headed and say, like, this is Dunstable, I've worked in the city and I know everything about this and I know how to price up this. And I think I should have been a bit more humble in that situation and not have acted like that. And I guess that put the backup of the people that were trying to manage me at the time. And although I wasn't always wrong when I fought against them, it probably wasn't the right thing to do. And I sat there pricing up racing for them, and they wanted a totally different method where you take both sides of the market with a decent customer base. And that's definitely the way forward, because look, they're a successful company that are still trading in a very, very competitive, hard area. And I think I went in there far too opinionated because of my age and what I'd been given so early to do at City Index. And I think being that opinionated person, even though I was making money for them, and we used to have a trader table, and I was always towards the top of that, so I wouldn't say I was losing money for them, but a lot of decisions I made could have actually made far more money for the company if I'd listened to them. And I think they quite rightly got a bit annoyed with that. And not only that, at the time, as I said to you, I was young. I was living in a place where I'd lived in London pretty much all my life, and I'd enjoyed working in London and having all the sort of excitement that brings, and with everything on your doorstep. And I was stuck in Dunstable, and I suppose my attitude reflected that as well. So I was probably quite difficult to manage. And very fortunately, they offered me a very generous settlement at the very time that someone from Sportingbet had said that they wanted to open up their fixed odds trading side because of the acquisitions that they were making in the online gaming sector, and would I be interested in taking a reasonably junior position on their fixed odds football side. And to be honest, I took a small pay cut just to get back to London.
Okay, so we move on to the PR department. How did you get into the PR work?
Well, it was interesting at City Index, going back to the City Index days, they had a couple of, you know, incredibly well-respected PR guys that had been doing it for a long, long time. And they were offered opportunities by Bloomberg TV quite often to go onto Bloomberg and talk about the prices of a weekend. And I think there was one particular Friday where our PR guy just couldn't make it, and Bloomberg were pretty desperate, and they were only around the corner from City Index offices. And the shout went up in the office, can anyone go round and talk about this weekend's football and our prices in place of our PR guy? And I think, you know, being sort of pretty overconfident and willing to try my hand at anything, I think I put my hand up pretty quickly and said, oh, I'll go around there, I'll do it. And I think I was dressed reasonably smartly that day and went round there, and they put a bit of makeup on you, or a lot of makeup in my case, and they said, right, we're going to talk about this weekend spread betting, and here are the prices. And I think that was quite a good environment to be in, because you do give opinionated views and you can talk about the prices based on opinion, and you're not sitting there talking about the way that they're coming in to trade a position. You're talking about the form of the match and the form of the team and your opinions on the way sides are playing. And I've got to say, I much preferred that to sitting there working out prices. And any other opportunity that arose during that year, I always stuck my hand up and said that I'll go and talk about it. Although I think I did one Bloomberg interview once where I got Burnley and Barnsley totally confused and did about 10 minutes on Burnley being Barnsley or Barnsley being Burnley. And how, I mean, if social media was around then, I would have been absolutely slaughtered, and every single clip, quite rightly, would have been shared and saying, this bloke has not got a clue. So again, I think I put it down to City Index being such a good, you know, learning ground for me because of that responsibility that was just given. You just wouldn't get it these days, you really wouldn't. So when I got to SpreadX, I kept the contacts from Bloomberg and carried on being SpreadX's face. Whenever I wasn't trading, I went and gave interviews for SpreadX on their behalf on Bloomberg, and got a lot better at remembering which team was which, and really enjoyed that. And I'd always had that in the back of my mind, that that was something very enjoyable. And when I got to Sporting Bet, I was on their football desk, and there was a great bunch of characters working there. You know, some really good guys. Some of them I'm still working with now as the merry-go-round of the industry, and others that I keep in contact with. And at Sporting Bet, a very similar thing happened, actually. I think the PR guy that they had wasn't particularly well, but a reasonably long-term illness, and thankfully it's something that he recovered from. But they were thrust into a situation where they didn't have anyone to do their PR, and I put my hand up to do it. And eventually the marketing team approached the trading director and said that they wanted to take me on full time as the PR person, as this person wasn't going to return to work. And that was an interesting crossroads, because my son had just been born, so you're talking sort of 13, 14 years ago. And I think, as people that are watching will know from a trading background, you do have to put in the hours, you really do. Okay, you're going to be watching sport from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. on a Saturday, and believe me, those were the shifts that you were doing. You know, you were in pricing up matches and adding extras to matches at 8 a.m. and you were only sort of switching off the computer and going home once the Spanish match had finished at 11 o'clock. And some people won't even work 4 hours, 5 hours on a Saturday. We were working nearly 10 hours on a Saturday, 12 hours. So those hours were suddenly impacting on what I wanted to be, you know, a family life. And I was given the immediate, I wouldn't say get out, because it was, you know, it was a great offer, the immediate switch to be able to go into the PR side for Sporting Bet and take a 9-to-5 role, pretty much a 9-to-5 role, Monday to Friday within their offices, and on a wage that was significantly more than I was earning in trading. So it was an absolute no-brainer for me, and I threw myself into that wholeheartedly.
So now you're head man for the PR at Betway. Now, looking outside, the PR man's got a pretty nice job, wining and dining clients, smoozing up to people. Is it such a lavish lifestyle? What is the reality in the day in the life of a bookie's PR?
I think it's obvious I'm going to say no, it's not all about that. I think anyone that's worked in a firm and has been close to any of the PR people that you work with, they do sometimes get a bad reputation within the company. Most of it's just a bit of ribbing and the fact that, yes, you are out and about a lot of the time, and some of that does involve entertainment. It's not all about that at all. I mean, I'll give you an example. Cheltenham Week, I'm probably coming into the office just down the road here, and I'm leaving the office, and everyone's saying, enjoy yourself at Cheltenham, you know, you'll have a great time. And really, you're actually thinking, this is my hardest week of work that I will undertake in the course of the whole year. And the first time an alcoholic drink will touch my lips on the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and Friday is probably way after 6 p.m. at night. And I've probably got to the track at 7 o'clock in the morning. Don't get me wrong, I'm not moaning about my job in any particular way, but I think there's a lot of misinformation about what the PR guys get up to and how hard the job is. I wouldn't swap it, but it's not all champagne and whining and dining. It really is a role that you can work as hard or as easily as you want to, and make of it what you will. But I would say the vast majority of my counterparts are working extremely hard, and we're some of the first lot of people that are in a press room at a racetrack of a weekend, and some of the last to leave.
Okay, right, you are the person they look to when things go horribly wrong. So what is the biggest disaster you've had to be the face of and try and defuse for a bookmaker?
I think there have been a few down the years from the various firms that I've worked for. I remember one of the fixed odds firms that I was a PR person, spokesman for, was my second PR job, which was Blue Square. And I think they had a maximum payout that they'd gone publicly with the amount that the person had won, but then actually reduced the amount based on the maximum payout that the person was paid. And obviously, if you manage it from a PR point of view, you would have checked that amount first of all. But I think our customer services had inadvertently told the customer they'd won X amount, when if we'd checked our rules, they'd won Y. And the person quite rightly went to at the races and made a quite a thing of it, as I think most people would. And I remember having to defend that on at the races. And sometimes in the PR role, you will be trying to defend something that I wouldn't say is indefensible, but it's very hard to explain why it's happening. I don't think any firm has ever tried to pull the wool over eyes in terms of rule book and things like that, but this was probably the situation where you didn't follow the rule book and had to say that the punter deserved the money. So that was an extremely difficult one, because there probably was no answer from that company's point of view as to why that all unfolded.
And did he get the money? Where did it end up?
I think they met him halfway, which I think is a fair enough. I think that's a fair enough resolution, because obviously if the customer service person hadn't spoken to him, he'd have only ever got the maximum payout. And if not, I think it would have been difficult to justify paying him less anyway. The other thing that was quite difficult, it was a social media incident with West Ham United. Betway sponsored West Ham United, and I think one of the social media team had actually tweeted about a substitution which had been made during the Bilic era, and I think that the club weren't particularly pleased with that, and it came out in the press that someone had criticised the team from within the sponsors. And I think we've seen it happen at other companies as well. We did manage to eventually split that over with the football club. So that wasn't a particularly difficult one, but that was more of a high profile one.
Okay, Alan, you said that it's not all champagne and dining out. So what are the best and worst parts of being a bookmaker's PR?
Look, the best part is that I attended nearly every major race meeting in the country last year with expenses paid, albeit doing a job where you need to work hard. So to be able to attend all of those events is something that I could never have dreamed of when I was younger. And I think that is always brought home to me whenever something significant occurs. For instance, I always remember bunking off school during the Chester May meeting. I was absolutely fascinated with Chester and the way they used to cover it on Channel 4, because it was such a unique course. And I remember that week in May, if it wasn't already off for May holidays, then I would make sure that at least two of them I would pretend to be ill and watch it at home. And I just remember Chester was this fascinating place for me as a race course. And we then, as a company at Betway, sponsored the Chester Cup. And I remember handing over that trophy. And for me, that it might not mean much to other people, but to have been sitting there as a sort of 13, 14-year-old watching that with my dad, and then to be able to present that trophy for that race. Okay, it's not riding in it, it's not training the winner, it's not owning the winner by any means, but just being involved to that extent, I could never have imagined that. And again, to an even bigger extent, last year we've got a major sponsorship at Betway's partnership at the Grand National. In 6 or 7 races at last year's meeting, I'm handing over the trophy. And again, that's something I could not have dreamed of when I sat there in the Easter holidays with my dad watching the racing from Aintree. And you know, I do have to pinch myself at times, so that's definitely the best part. The worst part is, I think we've seen in the last week, you know, some of my counterparts were getting stick on an anonymous account on Twitter earlier in the week because, I mean, some shocking stuff. And, you know, these people have got families, they have carved out a career in the game. You do not fluke a career in PR, you do not fluke a career in the trading side of the game. People are found out pretty quickly. Don't get me wrong, there are people that probably have climbed ladders that everyone has turned their nose up at and said, how has he got that job, how has he done that? That happens in every single industry. But there are hard-working people that are working in the PR side, and there are hard-working people behind the scenes. And unfortunately, people have been given a platform now to attack these people. I must admit, I don't think I've ever had it that bad. Compared to some of the stick I've seen flying around. What I'll try and do is, if it's an account in a person's own name that's tweeting me a genuine concern about my firm, whether the firm's right or the punter's right, I'll definitely try and resolve that, whether that be privately by taking the person's number and giving them a call, or a direct message, or if it's a very simple thing, passing it on to a customer service. What I can't abide is people coming on in anonymous accounts and making accusations, because we used to investigate those, or we used to try and get the account usernames of people like that. And I can wholeheartedly say now that 95% of the time these people aren't actually giving the whole story on Twitter, and they're whipping up a storm about companies and about bookmakers without actually giving that key snippet of information that would mean that the bookmaker was well within their rights to ask for an additional piece of ID or something a bit extra from the punter, or have essentially stuck by their rules, and that's why punter A isn't getting their money. But don't get me wrong, you know, bookmakers will sometimes fall foul of their own rules. And I think we had a rule last year that, and I forget the event now, and I forget the sport, but I think we essentially had a rule that didn't quite, it was a good rule in principle within our set of rules when you sign up, but there was a certain thing that happened that, I think it was something to do with postponed matches and whether your bet stood. And we took on the feedback of the customers, and I took on the feedback that I was getting on Twitter. And I said, actually, do you know what? You guys are completely right. In this instance, the rule doesn't fit, and we changed our rules and we gave everyone a refund. So sometimes it is worth opening your ears and listening to punters' concerns, because sometimes the rule won't have been put in place maliciously by the company to catch people out. It'll be there and it might not serve the right purpose, and it can be adapted. And we're always open to doing that. And I think most people that have ever got in touch with me, whether the ruling's gone in their favour or our favour, they'll admit that we've at least opened up that dialogue.
Do you think the bookmaking industry shoots itself in the foot more than other industries when it comes to public relations gaffes like that?
Not necessarily. I think we're dealing with a very different kind of PR. I remember when one of my previous companies was taken over, and it meant a lot of us were losing our jobs. I do remember going for a drink with the traders that afternoon and them all saying, well, you'll be all right, you're in PR. That transfers to all different industries. And I actually sort of really disagree with that. I must say that the bookmaker PR is completely different. Bookmakers are the only industry that I can think of that actually compete with their customers. The customer can win off you, you can win off the customer. It's an ongoing two-way relationship. Whereas if you're a PR person for a car company, the car is the product, people buy the car, people drive the car. You're not in competition with those people. You're not trying to, the customer's not trying to beat the company when they're buying a car off them. And that competition between punter and bookmaker means that the PR role for a bookmaker is completely different to anywhere else. So I would say that it's a very different role that's not transferable.
Okay, so ultimately in your job, you're trying to get more punters to bet on you. So are you best served looking for loads of fiver and tenner punters, or are you looking for a whale, a big punter, high staking? What would be your ultimate aim?
I think that question probably would be more aimed to our advertising side, because I think they're the ones that have a direct impact on who a company's trying to actually get through the door. I think my remit is to get enough exposure for Betway that people recognise the brand when they're seeing adverts and when they're actually making their choice as to which bookmaker to use. Ours is front of mind because of all the PR stuff that we've done, keeping our name in the press for the right reasons. So where that actually ends up in the cycle of whether the punter is a £5 punter, leisure punter, or a big hitter is I think is enough far removed from PR that we don't need to worry about it.
So with that in mind, what's the best and worst things you've seen done to promote a bookmaker? It doesn't have to be one you've been involved with.
I think a lot of people are critical of the banter side of social media that a lot of bookmakers have now picked up on, whether it be criticising teams and say, you know, even us at Betway, even trying to make a particularly nuanced statement about a substitution foul of that, with the team getting annoyed, but some that are just generally there for the, I suppose no better word for it than the banter side of either football supporting or other sports. I think sometimes I cringe at that. I think a lot of adverts in the industry are cringeworthy. I mean, I've worked at a company that had probably one of the worst ones. I think Blue Square had one of the worst adverts I've ever seen. They had feedback from customers saying that the site was incredibly easy to use and that was the major selling point of the company, but what the marketing people at that company failed to realise at the time is if you're speaking to people that use your site day in, day out, they're obviously going to say it's easy to use, but a whole hook was put around getting straight to the bet, and I think they called it getting straight to the Blue Square bet, which is a sentence that doesn't even make sense, and they had a whole range of adverts based on that, and a few of those people are still out there, and I'd say that was a particularly cringeworthy advert. But look, I mean, I've seen adverts even now for some of our competitors that use wording that doesn't particularly make sense, and I think they could be a lot better. But I think it's like everything, you pay a lot of attention to the kind of adverts and news within your own industry, and then you maybe don't see it when it's in other industries. So I think we might be in a bit of a bubble where we pay more attention to adverts and statements and things that go on in our industry, where a lot of people wouldn't even come across their radar that an advert is particularly different from any other advert in the industry.
Well, one thing we've seen in the bookmaking industry is it's changing rapidly, you know, year on year, month on month, with, you know, social media, internet betting, etc. How do you see the betting industry and bookmaking landscape in 5 to 10 years' time?
it's a really hard one because the advances will go across loads of different sections of the industry. So one will be technology, and you know, I'm quite freely admit I'm that probably is one of the channels that I wouldn't be particularly expert in, so I wouldn't be able to tell you which new technological advances are going to happen over the next 5-10 years in the industry. On my side, I think content is king. The videos that we're recording now, I mean, I'm a huge fan of these videos and the way that they are used to promote a bookmaker, and I think a lot of people really enjoy watching them. Maybe not this one, but let's hope so. And I think in my company Betway, we try and give a slightly different spin to the content. I don't think we're particularly involved in the banter side. We try and inform and educate. We do a few fun videos whenever we got the assets, like West Ham players. We did a nice little video with Jack Wilshere last week where we pranked him with a couple of the other players interviewing him through a journalist that was a plant in the room, and you know, that got great numbers on social media, and it got a lot of impact for the company. And in a way, that's PR, but that's content PR. So I think that is quite a heavy avenue to invest in, especially if any legislation comes in that prevents advertising as we know it, because content will then be king, and you'll have to be very good at that. And I think we are, and I think these videos are.
Okay, Alan, I know it's a bit creepy, but I had to Google you, and something I found that was quite interesting. You're a bit of an actor. Tell us about the Bromley Boys.
Yeah, of people who follow me on Twitter, it is in my bio. It's obviously there as much of a joke as scoring the last goal at Highbury, because I'm not really a part-time actor. I was offered a part in a film. I don't think I'll be offered parts in any other films. But the Bromley Boys was a film, or is a film, that was made about a non-league club in the division that I worked in for a long while. It happens to be the club that my dad now supports after him supporting Chelsea and getting annoyed with all their money and thinking that he wanted to go back to grassroots. So he's a season ticket holder at Bromley. And it just so happened that there's an extremely well thought of book in non-league circles called The Bromley Boys, which sells incredibly well, and it's just one man, Dave Roberts, account of supporting them when they were the worst team in the country. And it happened at a time when England had just won the World Cup, so if you can imagine, the whole mood regarding football in the country is everyone on a high, and this young kid supports the team that's actually on the biggest, lowest of the low. And the book received really good reviews and was optioned by a local filmmaker called TJ Herbert, and he always had this idea that he would take the season that Bromley had, and not word for word Dave's words, because no disrespect to Dave, it just is an account of him telling what he bought on the way to the, you know, way to the game. We had a kick out on the train, we lost 2-1, so I don't think that would have made a good film. But the concept behind the film, as in Bromley having a terrible season but everyone loves football in the country because England has just won the World Cup, was something that the filmmaker wanted to put out as a story. I think the script was written by one guy where they didn't quite get the comedy angle, and then it was passed to another guy. So I was just asked to look at it because I was working in non-league football at the time, and also there's a betting element to the film, if you watch the film, and you should. And they just asked me to sense check the non-league stuff within it. I mean, I wasn't around in the 60s, obviously, as you can see, but I checked out the season that Bromley had and the way that the games actually came about, and the location for where the film was going to be shot, because Bromley's stadium has been redeveloped beyond recognition from the 60s. And I was so involved that by the time they actually got a cast in place and the script had been changed by Warren Dudley, the guy that wrote what actually became the film script, I was asked to actually go and listen to the actors read it to see if there was anything else I could comment on. And it was pretty much thrust upon me because I went down to Soho on a lunch break, and extended lunch break, I must admit. And I was there and they said to me, do you want to actually read this part that's in the film? Would you like to take pages 50 and 56? There's a part of a local reporter. Instead of you just listening for an hour and a half, do you want to just, when it comes to that, do you want to give those two lines? And I gave them, and at the end of the read through, the casting director came up to me and said, do you know what? You could probably do that role. So I said, really? Yeah, you could do that. So, you know, with modesty, I said, all right, yeah, I wouldn't mind, get in touch with me. And they did. And say Betway gave me 2 days away from the office to go and film with the crew on location. It was down in Swanley in Kent, because as I say, Bromley's ground couldn't be used, so they used a ground down in Swanley in Kent. And I spent 2 days in a trailer with actors from films and comedies and TV shows that I'd sort of grown up watching or even watch as an adult, and it was great to be involved for 2 days. But I tell you what, I don't think I could do it. I enjoy my own job too much, and that might sound sort of a bit boastful to people saying, bloody hell, you know, what, you've turned down being an actor. But in fact, sitting around in the trailer, once you've gone through all the conversations, it is pretty boring, and you go into makeup for an hour or so, and then you're dragged out to give a line that lasts 2 minutes if you can do it in one take, a lot longer if you can't, and then you're off and away, and you don't really see much of a story going on, you're not particularly involved, and by the time you watch it on the screen, it doesn't really feel like the day that you had. So I loved it, wouldn't swap it for the world, but I think it will stick as part-time and probably my only film credit. But it's out on DVD, it did really well in the cinema until, unfortunately, they were hit by, because of the heat wave, people just weren't going to the cinema, so the sales of tickets dropped off. But it's got some really good reviews, really enjoyed doing it.
And EastEnders producers can put their darling finger away then.
Well, look, I'll take each offer on a case-by-case basis.
Right, keep sticking on the non-league football angle, and a lot more serious. Once again, my creepy googling, I found an article that you've written a few years ago about the corruption in non-league matches. Now, I understand you want to tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, I always think it's an interesting subject. I mean, to give you the background, my second PR job in the industry actually combined two things that, you know, I've really enjoyed doing. Obviously, it was for a betting company, and then it was the first ever betting company that was sponsoring a non-league division, and that was the conference. So Blue Square took that on board in the 2007-08 season. Sporting Bet had just moved to Guernsey. They wanted traders to relocate. I didn't want to leave my son behind in London. There was no way I really wanted to do that, although I didn't really have any other offers to stay in London. And again, it's just one of those things, a bit like the City Index advert, sometimes at your lowest point, and I firmly believe this, I'm not into stars and fate and things like that, but I also believe that sometimes things can just hit you without any kind of planning whatsoever. And it was actually a recruitment agency phoned me and they said, that I can't see it anywhere on your CV, do you know much about non-league football? I said, yeah, anywhere I've ever lived, I've always gone to the local non-league club and always been involved, kept in touch with it. I've even compiled for non-league. They said there's a company that have just sponsored a non-league division, and they're also a betting company, and there's a real specific requirement to know about the prices. We want to put you in touch with them. And when I went to the interview, it was actually at Blue Square, and they said, look, we're sponsoring the top three divisions in non-league football. We've also got a media deal with Setanta, which means that we will have someone on the touchline as a touchline reporter to actually talk about odds. So this was the first and possibly last time it'll ever be used, because I guess now there's, I suppose, obviously football and betting do go hand in hand, but I don't think there's the clamour to promote it too much from a broadcaster's point of view nowadays. But Setanta had that freedom in 2007 and said that the Blue Square reporter will be a thing. So it was amazing. It was an amazing job to just be thrust into, working with 68 non-league clubs and also going travelling around all of these clubs on the live matches, and they showed about 60 a season. I mean, BT Sports show it now, it's only about 20 a season. 60 to 80 games a season. We were travelling from York to Torquay, back to Exeter, and all over the country as a TV crew. It was amazing. And I would, the key thing that they needed was someone that can make up the prices before they actually loaded online. So the goal would go in during the match, and I would have to come up with what the new prices would be, and they'd have to be reasonably in line with what we were just about to release online as a company. And obviously you needed a trading background to be able to know that the 4-6 favourites just gone 1-0 up in a goals expectancy game of 2.8 goals. If they've just gone up 1-0 up in the first 20 minutes, what does the 4-6 now become? And by no means going to say that I'm the best at that, but I could do it to a degree of failability that was enough to be on air and give those prices. And so they would throw down to the touchline, and I would be there with a microphone and say, right, okay, you know, Weymouth have just gone 1-0 up in this game. They are now 4-1 on. If you want to back the away team, they're now 8-1. And it was great. It was great to be able to do that. Obviously, at that time, or about a year and a half after that, there were lots of rumours that non-league football did have a corruption problem, and that came to a head at the end of the 2008-09 season, where Forest Green Rovers played away at Grays Athletic, and on the Saturday, it was actually the Racing Post that flagged up that three companies had suspended the half-time, full-time betting in that game, which was one team to be leading at half-time, the other team to come back and win, which, as most people in football betting will know, is quite a high-priced double-result market. Another thing that people in the betting industry will know is that you don't really take that much on that market, especially when it's a non-live, non-league game on a Sunday. It was the final game of the weekend, so it was moved to a Sunday, and we were actually at Torquay, where Burton Albion were trying to get over the line. We'd already paid out on them. We'd gone 100-1 on, paid out on them in March. They limped over the line to the extent where Cambridge could have stolen it off them on the day. Cambridge and their chairman delayed the kickoff, I guess on purpose, to see what was going on at Burton away at Torquay. And I remember the Torquay physio chatting to me on the sidelines, saying, what's happening at Forest Green Grays? And he not only told me what the score would be, he told me who would get the first goal. And this wasn't the days of smartphones giving you a goal scorer pretty quickly on an alert. He told me who would score the first goal and how it would be scored. And lo and behold, at half time, checking on the BBC website, he had it exactly right. And the guy didn't have the internet, he didn't have the phone anywhere near him. And obviously something very drastically wrong had gone on there. And I confidently said on Radio 5 that there was fixing in that game. One of the managers involved in that game subsequently told me that I was 100% correct and there was fixing in that game. And unfortunately, the authorities just didn't have enough to tie it together. And Blue Square lost a lot of money on that. And I think it was William Hill as well. And I know that you've interviewed Graham Sharp, but he was at the forefront of trying to get that to more prominent. But what then happened was, because that came out in the media, people were looking for it everywhere. And earlier in that season, I think it was Weymouth were playing a game against Rushden & Diamonds. And what had happened in the local area is that the players knew that their insurance was invalid and they weren't going to risk their careers, so that Weymouth were going to play a youth team. Now, to me, that's team news and insight. That's not fixing. That youth team from Weymouth went out on the pitch that day to go and win against Rushden & Diamonds. They weren't capable of doing it, and that's why they got beat. I think it was 8-0 or 9-0 on the day. But anyone that was ahead of that team news, I think they won money fair and square that day. But then obviously the FA had to tighten it up and say that the insight into team news is also an offence being passed on from any employee within the game. I think that's a bit draconian, in that if you've got a non-league player in the National League South, he may have played in the second round of the FA Cup. He's not going to be playing in the final, and his season is actually over by then. By the time the FA Cup comes round, pretty much, you know, 90% of the National League South clubs have finished their season by then. He could well be sitting in a pub with his mates, and the FA Cup final could be on, the current legislation prevents him from having a fiver on the first goal scorer in that game. You might think that's right. I think that that is wrong. I think that as long as that guy's not betting on anything he can influence, it should be okay that he can bet on the World Cup final, the FA Cup final, things like that. But I do also understand that the FA have to say it's blanket, it's overall, because how do you police it otherwise? So they're in a very, 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 very difficult situation. There are far more sinister fixes that have gone on in the non-league game in recent years, which also came to light, which involved, you know, players being moved around to fix games, and also being moved countries to fix games, and you know, there's enough proof out there on enough websites to say that did happen in non-league football. I like to think it's a lot cleaner now, but you know, sometimes you see a result where you raise an eyebrow. But I think it's like everything, you do have to trust that the vast majority of people are honest.
Okay, Alan, we've given everybody a great insight to your job and your history in the game. I always like to ask people, what advice would you give anybody watching this, young lad or lady, who fancies following in your footsteps, in a nutshell?
I think in a nutshell, it's a lot harder now. I think people might watch this video back and say that a few lucky breaks occurred whereby I managed to get myself in an industry that I wholeheartedly wanted to be part of, and you know, have loved every day, and I mean that. I don't think I've ever, not many people can say this, I think in the last, you know, 20 years, nearly 20 years I've been in the industry, I don't think there's been a morning I've woken up where I say, I don't want to go to work today. And if you can have that, then it's an amazing thing. I don't think that the path I managed to get there on is available to anyone anymore. I don't think those lucky breaks exist. I think, you know, there are HR people in companies now that won't let an interview where you say I'm an Arsenal fan pass as being a required qualification for, and the only qualification for going and getting a position in a company, however junior. So I think it's all about education. It's about getting a degree and following the right path. And there are decent opportunities open to people in the betting industry. But what I would say is, and I think Graham Sharp touched on this in his interview, there are probably only 50 people that have ever done this job in the history of the world. You know, actually being a bookmaker's PR person, you know, it's not a widely known role or job. So as I say, I think there's only about 50 odd people that have ever done it. And the roles exist, and obviously they exist across all the companies, and including some of the bigger companies that have whole teams of PR positions, which would mean that there would be junior positions within that. So I would aim at one of those, not specifically going for the PR role, but certainly to work in the industry, get an understanding of the industry, and who knows, something lucky might happen. Someone might not turn up for work one day, and you might get to put your hand up and give an interview.
Okay, and I'm pretty sure that Betway's senior ranks have breathed a sigh of relief that you're not going to be heading off to Walford. But so what professional ambitions do you have for the future?
I'm not so sure about that. Certainly not on any on the acting side. Again, I'm not someone that's ever sort of planned out and said, right, this is my career map before me. I think a lot of things just happen and just, for want of a better phrase, rolled with it. I would say to continue working at, you know, what is I've found to be, you know, one of the best companies I've worked for, if not the best. You might say he's only saying that because of the position he's in. No, I strongly agree with that. It's you know, it's an interesting industry to work in, and as long as I can continue to do that in any capacity, that's either senior to or the same as this PR role I've got here, I think that'll be good enough for me.
Great stuff. Alan Alger, thank you very much.
You can follow Star Sports on Twitter at @StarSports_bet, our Facebook page at @StarSportsBet, and also view all our latest videos on YouTube at Star Sports. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.